Time Warner Audiobooks presents The Secret of Shambhala, The Search for the 11th Insight, written by James Redfield and performed by LeVar Burton. Also featuring an introduction read by the author.
Dedication from Megan, from Kelly, whose generation must evolve consciously. Acknowledgements. In the evolution of spiritual awareness, there are many heroes. A special thanks is in order to Larry Dossey for his pioneering popularization of the scientific research on prayer and intention. Also, to Marilyn Schlitz, who continues to push the development of new studies on human intentionality for the Institute of Noetic Sciences. In nutrition, recognition must be given to the acid-alkaline work of Theodore A. Baruti and Robert Young. James Redfield would like to personally thank Albert Golden, John Austin, John Diamond, and Claire Zion, who all continue to make special contributions to this work. And most of all, a special thanks to Sally Merrill Redfield, whose intuition and faith power serves as a constant reminder of the mystery.
Hello, this is James Redfield. When I wrote The Celestine Prophecy and the 10th Insight, I was firmly convinced that human culture was evolving through a series of insights into life and spirituality, insights that could be described and documented. All that has occurred since has only deepened this belief. With the first 9 insights, we become fully conscious of a higher spiritual process operating behind the scenes in life. And in doing so, we are leaving behind a materialistic worldview that reduces life to survival, gives a pittance to some religion, and uses toys and distractions to push away the true awe of being alive. What we want instead is a life filled with mysterious coincidences and sudden intuitions that allude to a special path for ourselves in this existence, to a particular pursuit of information and expertise, as though some intended destiny is pushing to emerge. This kind of life is like a detective story, and the clues soon lead us forward through one insight after another. We discover that a real experience of the divine within awaits us, and if we can find this connection, our lives are infused with even more clarity and intuition. We begin to catch visions of our destiny, of some mission that we can accomplish, provided we work through our distracting habits, treat others with a new ethic, and stay true to our hearts. With the 10th insight, this perspective expands even more to include the full scope of history and culture. At some level, all of us know that we are born into this earthly dimension to participate in one overall goal, to slowly, generation by generation, create a completely spiritual culture on this planet. Yet even as we grasp this invigorating insight, a new one, the 11th, is arriving. Our thoughts and attitudes count in making our dreams come true. In fact, I believe we are on the verge of understanding finally the way our mental intentions, our prayers, even our secret opinions and assumptions influence not only our own success, but the success of others as well. Based on my own experience and on what is happening around us, this program is offered as an illustration of this next step in awareness. It is my belief that the 11th insight is already emerging out there, swirling among thousands of late-night spiritual discussions and hidden just below the hatred and fear that still mark our era. As before, our only responsibility is to live up to what we know and then to reach out and spread the word.
1. Fields of Intention. The phone rang, and I just stared at it. The last thing I needed now was another distraction. I tried to push it from my mind, gazing out the window at the trees and wildflowers, hoping to lose myself in the array of fall colors in the woods around my house. It rang again, and I got a vague but stirring image in my mind's eye of a person needing to talk with me. Quickly, I reached over and answered it. Hello? It's Bill, a familiar voice said. Bill was an agronomy expert who had been helping me with my garden. He lived down the ridge only a few hundred yards. "Listen, Bill, can I call you back later?" I said. "I've got this deadline." "You haven't met my daughter Natalie yet, have you?" "Excuse me?" "Bill?" "Listen," he finally answered. "My daughter wants to talk with you. I think it might be important. I'm not quite sure how she knows, but she seems to be familiar with your work. She says she has some information about a place you'd be interested in. Some location in the north of Tibet. She says the people there have some important information." "How old is she?" I asked. Bill chuckled on the other end of the line. "She's only 14, but she's been saying some really interesting things lately. She was hoping she could talk with you this afternoon before her soccer game. Any chance?" I started to put him off, but the earlier image expanded and started to become clear in my mind. It seemed to be of the young girl in me talking somewhere near the big spring just up from her house. "Yeah, okay," I said. "How about 2 p.m?" "That's perfect," Bill said. On the walk over, I caught sight of a new house across the valley on the north ridge. That makes almost 40, I thought, all in the last 2 years. I knew the word was out about the beauty of this bowl-shaped valley, but I really wasn't worried that the place would become overcrowded or that the amazing natural vistas would be destroyed. Nestled right up to a national forest, we were 10 miles from the closest town, too far away for most people. And the family who owned this land and was now selling selected house sites on the outer ridges seemed to be determined to keep the serenity of the place unspoiled. Each house had to be low slung and hidden amid the pines and sweet gums that defined the skyline. What bothered me more was the preference for isolation exhibited by my neighbors. From what I could tell, most were characters of a sort, refugees from careers in various professions who had carved out unique vocational niches that allowed them now to operate on flex time or travel on their own schedules as consultants, a freedom that was necessary if one was to live this far out in the wilderness. The common bonds among all of us seemed to be a persistent idealism and the need to stretch our particular professions by an infusion of spiritual vision, all in the best 10th insight tradition. Yet almost everyone in this valley stayed to themselves, content to focus on their diverse fields without much attention to community or the need to build on our common vision. This was especially true among those of different religious persuasions. For some reason, the valley had attracted people holding a wide range of beliefs, including Buddhism, Judaism, both Catholic and Protestant Christianity, and Islam. And while there was no hostility of any kind by one religious group toward another, there wasn't a feeling of affinity either. The lack of community concerned me, because there were signs that a few of our kids were displaying some of the same problems seen in suburbia. Too much time alone, too much video, and too much regard for the slights and put-downs at school. I was beginning to be concerned that there wasn't enough family and community in their lives to push these peer problems into the background and keep them in proper perspective. Up ahead, the path narrowed, and I had to make my way between two large boulders that edged right up to a sheer drop-off of about 200 feet. Once past, I could hear the first gurgles of Phillips Spring, named by the fur trappers that first set up a camp here in the late 17th century. The water trickled down several tiers of rocks into a lazy pool 10 feet across that had originally been dug out by hand. Successive generations had added features, such as apple trees up near the mouth and mortared stone to reinforce and deepen the pool. I walked up to the water and reached down to cup some in my hand, brushing a stick out of the way as I leaned forward. The stick kept moving, slithering up the rock face and into a hole. "Cottonmouth," I said aloud, stepping back and feeling the sweat pop out on my brow. There are still perils involved in living here in the wild, although not perhaps the ones that old man Phillips faced centuries ago, when you could turn a corner on the path one day and come face to face with a big cougar guarding her young, or worse, a pack of wild boars with 3-inch tusks that would slit your leg wide open if you didn't get up a tree fast enough. If the day was going especially bad, you might even come upon an angry Cherokee, or a displaced Seminole who was tired of finding some new settler on his favorite hunting grounds, and was harboring the conviction that a large bite of your heart would stem the European tide forever. No. Everyone alive in that generation, Native Americans and Europeans alike, faced direct perils that tested one's mettle and courage in the moment. Our generation seemed to be dealing with other problems, problems that are more related to our attitude toward life and the constant battle between optimism and despair. Everywhere are the voices of doom these days, showing us factual evidence that the modern Western lifestyle can't be sustained, that the air is warming, the terrorists' arsenals growing, the forests dying, and the technology running wild into a kind of virtual world that makes our kids crazy, and threatens to take us further and further into distraction and aimless surrealism. Countering this viewpoint, of course, are the optimists, who claim that history has been filled with doomsayers, that all our problems can be handled by the same technology that produced these perils, and that the human world has only begun to reach its potential. I stopped and looked out at the valley again. I knew that the Celestine vision lay somewhere in between these poles. It encompassed a belief in sustainable growth and humane technology, but only if pursued by an intuitive move toward the sacred, and an optimism based on a spiritual vision of where the world can go. One thing was certain. If those who believe in the power of vision are to make a difference, it had to begin right now, when we're poised in the mystery of the new millennium. The fact of it still awed me. How did we get lucky enough to be the ones alive when not only a century changed, but a thousand-year period as well? Why us? Why this generation? I got the feeling that larger answers were still ahead. I looked around the spring for a moment, half expecting Natalie to be up here somewhere. I was sure this was the intuition I'd had. She'd been here at the spring, only I seemed to be looking at her through a window of some kind. It was all very confusing. When I arrived at her house, there seemed to be no one home. I walked onto the deck of the dark brown A-frame and knocked on the door, loudly. No answer. Then, as I glanced around the left side of the house, something grabbed my attention. I was looking down a rock pathway that led past Bill's huge vegetable garden and up to a small grassy meadow on the very top of the ridge. Had the light changed? I looked up at the sky, trying to figure out what had occurred. I had seen a shift in the light in the meadow, as though the sun had been behind a cloud and then had suddenly peeked out, illuminating that specific area. But there were no clouds. I strolled up to the meadow and found the young girl sitting at the edge of the grass. She was tall and dark-haired, wearing a blue soccer uniform, and as I approached, she jerked around, startled. "Didn't mean to scare you," I said. She looked away for a moment, in the shy way a teenager might, so I squatted down to be at her eye level and introduced myself. She looked back at me with eyes much older than I expected. "We aren't living the insights here," she said. I was taken aback. "What? The insights? We aren't living them. What do you mean?" She looked at me sternly. "I mean, we haven't figured it out completely. There's more that we have to know." "Well, it's not that easy." I stopped. I couldn't believe I was being confronted by a 14-year-old like this. For an instant, a flash of anger swept across me. But then, Natalie smiled. Not a large smile, just an expression at the edges of her mouth that made her endearing. I relaxed and sat down on the ground. "I believe the insights are real," I said, "but they aren't easy. It takes time." She wasn't letting up. "But there are people who are living them now." I looked at her for a moment. "Where?" "In Central Asia. The Kunlun Mountains. I've seen it on the map." She sounded excited. "You have to go there. It's important. There's something changing. You have to go there now. You have to see it." As she said this, the expression on her face looked mature, authoritative, like that of a 40-year-old. I blinked hard, not believing what I was seeing. "You have to go there," she repeated. "Natalie," I said, "I'm not sure what you mean. What kind of place is it? She looked away. You said you saw it on the map. Can you show it to me? She ignored my question, looking distracted. What time is it? She asked slowly, stuttering. 2:15. I gotta go. Wait, Natalie, this place you were talking about, I gotta meet the team, she said. I'm going to be late. She was walking fast now, and I struggled to reach her. What about this place in Asia? Can you remember exactly where it is? As she glanced back at me over her shoulder, I saw only the expression of a 14-year-old girl with her mind on soccer. Back at home, I found myself totally distracted. What was that all about? I stared at my desk, unable to concentrate. Later, I took a long walk and a swim in the creek, finally deciding to call Bill in the morning and get to the bottom of the mystery. I retired early. At about 3 a.m., something woke me. The room was dark. The only light was seeping in around the base of the window blinds. I listened intently, hearing nothing but the usual sounds of the night, an intermittent chorus of crickets, the occasional drone of bullfrogs down by the creek, and far away, the low bark of a dog. I thought about getting up and locking the doors of the house, something I seldom ever did, but I shrugged off the idea, content to let myself ease back into sleep. I would have faded away altogether, except that in my last sleepy glance about the room, I noticed something different at the window. There was more light outside than before. I sat up and looked again. There was definitely more light coming in around the blinds. I pulled on some pants and walked over to the window and parted the wooden slats. Everything appeared normal. Where had that light come from? Suddenly, I heard a light knocking behind me. Someone was in the house. Who's there? I asked without thinking. No answer. I walked out of the bedroom and into the hall that led to the living room, thinking about going to the closet and getting out my snake rifle. But I realized the key to the closet was back in the dresser drawer by the bed. Instead, I carefully walked on. Without warning, a hand touched my shoulder. Shh, it's Will. I recognized the voice and nodded. When I reached for the light on the wall, he stopped me, then walked across the room and looked out through the window. As he moved, I realized that something about him was different from the last time I had seen him. He was somehow less graceful, and his features seemed completely ordinary, not slightly luminous as before. What are you looking for? I asked. What's going on? You scared me half to death. He walked back toward me. I had to see you. Everything has changed. I'm back where I was. What do you mean? He smiled at me. I think all this is supposed to be happening, but I can no longer enter the other dimensions mentally the way I could. I can still raise my energy to some degree, but I'm now firmly here in this world. He looked away for an instant. It's almost as though what we did in understanding the 10th insight was just a taste, a preview, a glimpse of the future, like in a near-death experience. And now it's over. Whatever we're to do now, we have to do right here, on this earth. I could never do it again anyway, I said. Will looked me in the eye. You know, we've received a lot of information about human evolution, about paying attention, about being guided forward by intuition and the coincidences. We've been given a mandate to hold a new vision, all of us, only we aren't making it happen at the level we can. Something in our knowledge is still missing. He paused for a minute and then said, I'm not sure why yet, but we have to go to Asia, somewhere near Tibet. Something is happening there, something we have to know. I was startled. Young Natalie had said the same thing. Will walked back to the window again, peering out. Why do you keep looking out the window? I asked. And why did you slip into the house? Why didn't you just knock? What's going on? Probably nothing, he replied. I just thought I was being followed earlier today. I couldn't be sure. He walked back toward me. I can't explain everything now. I'm not even sure myself of what is happening, but there is a place in Asia we must find. Can you meet me at the Hotel Himalaya in Kathmandu? on the 16th?
Wait a minute. Will, I have things to do here. I'm committed to...
Will looked at me with an expression I've never seen on anyone's face but his. A pure mixture of adventure and total intent.
It's okay, he said. If you're not there on the 16th, you're not there. Just be sure if you come that you stay perfectly alert. Something will occur.
He was serious about giving me the choice, but he was smiling broadly. I looked away, unamused. I didn't want to do this. The next morning, I decided I would tell no one where I was going except Charlene. The only problem was that she was on an assignment out of the country, and it was impossible to reach her directly. All I could do was leave her an email. I walked over to my computer and sent it, wondering, as I always did, about the security of the Internet. Hackers can get into the most secure corporate and government computers. How hard would it be to intercept email messages? Especially when one remembers that the Internet was originally set up by the Defense Department as a link to their research confidants at major universities. Is the whole Internet monitored? I shook off the concern, concluding that I was being silly. Mine was one message among tens of millions. Who would care? While I was on the computer, I made travel arrangements to arrive in Kathmandu, Nepal, on the 16th and stay at the Himalaya. I would have to leave in 2 days, I thought, barely enough time to make preparations. I shook my head. Part of me was fascinated with the idea of going to Tibet. I knew that its geography was one of the most beautiful and mysterious in the world, but it was also a country under the repressive control of the Chinese government, and I knew it could be a dangerous place. My plan was to go only as far with this adventure as felt safe. No more getting in over my head and letting myself be pulled into something I couldn't control. Will had left my home as quickly as he had arrived, without telling me anything more, and my mind was full of questions. What did he know of this place near Tibet? And why was an adolescent girl telling me to go there? Will was being very cautious. Why? I wasn't going a step beyond Kathmandu until I found out. When the day came, I tried to stay very alert through the long flights to Frankfurt, New Delhi, and then Kathmandu, but nothing of note occurred. At the Himalaya, I checked in under my own name and put my things in the room and then began to look around, ending up at the lobby restaurant. Sitting there, I expected Will to walk in any moment, but nothing happened. After an hour, the idea of going to the pool came to mind, so I hailed a bellman and found out it was outside. It would be slightly chilly, but the sun was bright, and I knew the fresh air would help me adjust to the altitude. I walked out the exit and found the pool in between the L-shaped wings of the building. There were more people there than I would have imagined, although few were talking. As I took a chair at one of the tables, I noticed that the people sitting around me, Asians mostly, with a few Europeans scattered about, seemed to be either stressed out or very homesick. They frowned at each other and snapped at the hotel attendants for drinks and papers, avoiding eye contact at all cost. Gradually, my mood began to decline as well. Here I was, I thought, cooped up in one more hotel halfway around the world without a friendly face anywhere. I took a breath and again remembered Will's admonition to stay alert. Reminding myself that he was talking about watching for the subtle twists and turns of synchronicity, those mysterious coincidences that could pop up in a second to push one's life in a new direction. Perceiving this mysterious flow, I knew, remained the central experience of real spirituality, direct evidence that something deeper was operating behind the scenes of the human drama. The problem has always been the sporadic nature of this perception. It comes along for a while to entice us and then, just as quickly, disappears. As I looked around the area, my eyes fell on a tall man with black hair who was walking out of the hotel door heading straight for me. He was dressed in tan slacks and a stylish white sweater and carried a folded newspaper under his arm. He walked along the path through the loungers and sat at a table directly to my right. As he took out his newspaper, he looked around and nodded to me, smiling, radiantly. Then he called an attendant over and ordered some water. He was Asian in appearance,
but he spoke in fluent English with no detectable accent. When his water arrived, he signed the ticket and began to read. There was something immediately attractive about this man, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. He just radiated a pleasant demeanor and energy, and periodically he would stop reading and look around with a wide smile. At one point, he made eye contact with one of the crabby gentlemen directly in front of me. I was half expecting the sullen man to look away quickly, but instead he smiled back at the dark-haired man and they began to engage in light conversation in what sounded like Nepalese. At one point, they even burst out laughing. Attracted by the conversation, several other people at nearby tables became amused, and one said something that created another round of laughter. I looked out on the scene with interest. Something was happening here, I thought. The mood around me was changing. "My God," the dark-haired man stammered, looking in my direction. "Have you seen this?" I looked around. Everybody else seemed to have returned to their reading, and he was pointing to something in the paper and moving his chair around to get closer to me. "They've released another prayer study," he added. "It's fascinating." "What did they find?" I asked. "They were studying the effect of praying for people who have medical problems and found that patients who received regular prayers from others had fewer complications and got well faster, even when they weren't aware that prayers were being said. It's undeniable proof that the force of prayer is real. But they also found something else. They found that the most effective prayer of all was structured not as a request, but as an affirmation." "I'm not sure what you mean," I said. He was staring at me with crystal blue eyes. "They set up the study to test two types of prayer. The first was just asking God, or the divine, to intervene, to help a sick person. The other was to simply affirm with faith that God will help the person. Do you see the difference?" "I'm still not sure." "A prayer that asks God to intervene assumes that God can intervene, but only if he decides to honor our request. It assumes that we have no role except to ask. The other form of prayer assumes that God is ready and willing, but has set up the laws of human existence so that whether the request is fulfilled depends in some part on the certainty of our belief that it will be done. So our prayer must be an affirmation that voices this faith. In the study, this kind of prayer proved to be the most effective." I nodded. I was beginning to get it. The man looked away as though thinking to himself and then continued, "All of the great prayers in the Bible are not requests, they are affirmations. Think of the Lord's Prayer. It goes, 'Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our trespasses.' It doesn't say, 'Please, can we have some food?' And it doesn't say, 'Please, can we be forgiven?' It merely affirms that these things are ready to happen already. And by faithfully assuming that they will, we make it so." He paused again, as though expecting a question, still smiling. I had to chuckle. His good mood was so contagious. "Some scientists are theorizing," he went on, "that these findings also imply something else, something that has a profound significance for every person alive. They maintain that if our expectations, our faithful assumptions, are what makes prayer work, then each of us is beaming a force of prayer energy out into the world all the time, whether we realize it or not. Do you see how this is true?" He continued, without waiting for me to answer, "If prayer is an affirmation based on our expectations, our faith, then all our expectations have a prayer effect. We are, in fact, praying all the time for some kind of future for ourselves and others. We just aren't fully aware of it." He looked at me as though he had just dropped a bombshell. "Can you imagine?" he continued. "Science is now confirming the assertions of the most esoteric mystics of every religion. They all say we have a mental and spiritual influence on what happens to us in life. Remember the scriptures about how faith the size of a mustard seed can move mountains? What if this ability is the secret of true success in life, of creating true community?" His eyes twinkled as though he knew more than he was saying. We all have to figure out how this works. It's time. I was smiling back at this man, intrigued by what he was saying, still amazed at the transformation in the mood around the pool, when I instinctively glanced around to the left in the way we do when we feel someone looking at us. I caught one of the pool attendants staring at me from the entrance door. When our eyes met, he quickly looked away and began to walk back along the sidewalk that led to an elevator. "Excuse me, sir," came a voice from behind me. When I looked around, I realized it was another attendant. "May I serve you a drink?" he asked. "No, thank you," I replied. "I'll wait a while." When I looked back toward the man on the sidewalk, he was gone. For a moment, I surveyed the area looking for him. When I looked over to my right, where the dark-haired man had been sitting, he was gone. I got up and asked the man at the table in front of me if he had seen which way the man with the paper had walked. He shook his head and looked away curtly. For the rest of the afternoon, I stayed in my room. The events at the pool were disconcerting. Who was the man telling me about prayer? Was there a synchronicity involved with this information? And why was the attendant staring at me? And where was Will? Around dusk, after a long nap, I ventured out again, deciding to walk down the street a few blocks to an outdoor restaurant. "Very close. Perfectly safe," the speckled concierge told me when I asked him how to get there. "No problem." I walked out of the lobby into the fading light, keeping an eye out for Will. The street was crowded with people, and I pushed my way through. When I arrived at the restaurant, I was given a small corner table next to a 4-foot-high wrought iron fence covered with ivy that separated the dining area from the street. I ate a leisurely dinner and read an English newspaper, keeping the table for more than an hour. At one point, I grew uncomfortable. I felt as though I was being watched again, only I couldn't see anyone looking. I gazed around at the other tables, but no one seemed to be paying me the slightest attention. Standing up, I peered over the fence at the people on the street. Nothing. Struggling to shake the feeling, I paid the check and walked back toward the hotel. As I neared the entrance, I caught sight of a man at the edge of a row of bushes about 20 feet away to my left. Our eyes met, and he took a step toward me. I looked away and was walking past when I realized it was the attendant I had caught looking at me at the pool. Only he was now dressed in sneakers and jeans with a plain blue shirt. He appeared to be about 30, with very serious eyes. I hurried on by. "Excuse me, sir," he called out. I continued to walk. "Please," he said, "I must speak with you." I moved a few yards further so that I would be in sight of the doorman and bell staff and then asked, "What is it?" He moved closer, half bowing. "You are someone I believe I am here to meet. You know Mr. Wilson James?"
"Will?
Yes. Where is he?" "He is unable to come. He asked me to meet you instead." He offered his hand, and I took it reluctantly, telling him my name. "I am Yin Dolo," he replied.
"Are you an employee here at the hotel?" I asked.
"No, I'm sorry. A friend works here. I borrowed a jacket from him so I could look around. I wanted to see if you were here." I looked at him closely. My instincts told me he was telling the truth, but why the secrecy? Why didn't he just walk up to me at the pool and ask who I was? "Why has Will been delayed?" I asked.
"I am not sure. He asked me to meet you and take you on to Lhasa. His plan, I believe, is to meet us there."
I looked away. Things were beginning to feel ominous. I looked him over again, then said, "I'm not sure I want to do that. Why hasn't Will called me himself?"
"I'm sure there is an important reason," Yen replied, taking a step toward me. "Will was very insistent that I bring you to him. He needs you."
Yen's eyes were pleading.
"Could we leave tomorrow?"
"Let's do this," I said. "Why don't you come inside and we'll have a cup of coffee and talk about the situation?" He was looking around as though afraid of something. "Please, I'll come back at 8 tomorrow morning.
Will has already arranged a flight and visa for you.
He smiled, then scurried away before I could protest. At 7:55, I walked out the door of the main lobby with only one satchel. The hotel had agreed to store everything else. My plan was to be back within the week, unless, of course, something strange happened once I left with Yen. In that case, I would be back immediately. Exactly on time, Yen drove up in an old Toyota, and we headed toward the airport. On the way over, he was cordial, but he continued to plead ignorance as to what was going on with Will. I considered telling him what Natalie had said about the mysterious place in Central Asia and what Will had told me that night in my bedroom just to see Yen's reaction, but I decided against it. Better to just watch Yen closely, I thought, and see how things felt at the airport. At the ticket desk, I found that a seat had indeed been purchased in my name for a flight to Lhasa. I looked around and tried to feel out the situation. Everything seemed normal. Yen was smiling, obviously in a good mood. Unfortunately, the ticket clerk was not. She could speak only a little English and was very demanding. When she asked for my passport, I became ever more irritated and snapped back at her. At one point, she stopped and glared at me, as though she was going to refuse to issue the tickets altogether. Yen quickly stepped in and talked to her in a calm voice in her native Nepalese. After a few minutes, her demeanor began to change. She never looked at me again, but she spoke pleasantly to Yen, actually laughing at something he said. A few minutes later, we had our tickets and boarding passes, and we were sitting at a small table in a coffee shop near our gate. There was the strong smell of cigarettes everywhere. "You have much anger," Yen said, "and you don't use your energy very well." I was taken aback. "What are you talking about?" He looked at me with kindness. "I mean, you did nothing to help the woman at the counter with her mood." I immediately knew what he was getting at. In Peru, the Eighth Insight had described a method of uplifting others by focusing on their faces in a particular way. "You know the Insights?" I asked. He nodded, still looking at me. "Yes," he said, "but there is more." "Remembering to send energy is not that easy," I added defensively. In a very deliberate tone, Yen said, "But you must realize that you were already influencing her with your energy anyway, whether you know it or not. The important thing is how you set your field of, Yen was struggling to find the English word, "field of intention," he said finally, "your prayer field." I looked at him hard. Yen seemed to be describing prayer in the same way the dark-haired man had earlier. "What are you talking about exactly?" I asked. "Have you ever been in a room of people where the energy and mood were low, and then someone comes in who lifts everyone's energy immediately just by entering the room? This person's energy field goes out ahead of him or her and touches everyone else." "Yeah," I said, "I know what you mean." His look penetrated me. "If you are going to find Shambhala, you must learn how to do this consciously." "Shambhala? What are you talking about?" Yen's face grew pale, exuding an expression of embarrassment. He shook his head, apparently feeling as though he had overstepped himself and let something out of the bag. "Never mind," he said lowly. "It is not my place. Will must explain this." The line was forming to enter the plane, and Yen turned away and moved toward the ticket steward. I was racking my brain, trying to place the word Shambhala. Finally, it came to me. Shambhala was the mythical community of Tibetan Buddhist lore, the one that the stories about Shangri-La had been based on. I caught Yen's eye. "That place is a myth, right?" Yen just handed the steward his ticket and walked down the aisle. On the flight to Lhasa, Yen and I sat in different sections of the plane, giving me time to think. All I knew was that Shambhala was of great significance to Tibetan Buddhists, whose ancient writings describe it as a holy city of diamonds and gold, filled with adepts and lamas, and hidden somewhere in the vast uninhabitable regions of northern Tibet or China. More recently, though, Most Buddhists seem to speak of Shambhala merely in symbolic terms, as representing a spiritual state of mind, not a real location. I reached over and pulled a travel brochure of Tibet from the pouch on the seat back, hoping to get a renewed sense of its geography. Lying between China to the north and India and Nepal to the south, Tibet is basically a large plateau with few areas lower than 6,000 feet. At its southern border are the towering Himalayas, including Mount Everest, and on the northern border, just inside China, are the vast Kunlun Mountains. In between are deep gorges, wild rivers, and hundreds of square miles of rocky tundra. From the map, eastern Tibet seemed to be the most fertile and populated, while the north and west looked sparse and mountainous, with few roads, all of them gravel. Apparently, there are only two major routes into western Tibet: the northern road, used mostly by truckers, and the southern road, which skirts the Himalayas and is used by pilgrims from all over the region to reach the sacred sites of Everest, Lake Manasarovar, and Mount Kailash, and further on to the mysterious Kunluns. I looked up from my reading. As we flew along at 35,000 feet, I began to sense a distinct shift in temperature and energy outside. Below me, the Himalayas rose in frozen rocky spires, framed by a clear blue sky. We practically flew right over the top of Mount Everest as we passed into the airspace of Tibet, the land of snows, the rooftop of the world. It was a nation of seekers, inward travelers, and as I looked down at the green valleys and rocky plains surrounded by mountains, I couldn't help being awed by its mystery. Too bad it was now being brutally administered by a totalitarian government. What, I wondered, was I doing here? I looked back at Yen seated four rows behind me. It bothered me that he was being so secretive. I made up my mind again to be very cautious. I would not go any further than Lhasa without a full explanation. When we arrived at the airport, Yin resisted all my inquiries about Shambhala, repeating his assertion that soon we would be met by Will, at which point I would learn everything. We caught a taxi to a small hotel near the center of town, where we would be met by Will. I caught Yin staring at me. "What?" I asked. "I was just checking to see how you are adjusting to the altitude," Yin said. "Lhasa is 12,000 feet above sea level. You must take it easy for a while." I nodded, appreciating his concern, but in the past I had always adapted easily to high altitudes. I was about to mention this to Yin when I caught sight of a huge, fortress-like structure in the distance. "This is the Potala Palace," Yin said. "I wanted you to see it. It was the Dalai Lama's winter home before he was exiled. It now symbolizes the struggle of the Tibetan people against the Chinese occupation." He looked away and remained silent until the car stopped not in front of the hotel, but down the street 100 feet. "Will should be here already," Yin said as he opened the door. "Wait in the taxi. I'll go in and check." But instead of getting out, he stopped and stared at the entrance. I saw his look and gazed in that direction myself. The street was busy with Tibetan pedestrians and a few tourists, but all seemed normal. Then my eyes fell on a short Chinese man near the corner of the building. He held a paper of some kind, but his eyes were carefully surveying the area. Yin looked toward the cars parked on the curb across the street from the man. His eyes stopped on an old brown sedan containing several men in suits. Yin said something to the driver, who looked nervously at us in the rearview mirror, and drove toward the next intersection. As we drove on, Yin bent over so as not to be seen by the men in the car. "What's going on?" I asked. Yin ignored me, telling the driver to turn left and head further into the center of the city. I grabbed his arm. "Yin, tell me what's going on. Who were those men?" "I don't know," he said, "but Will would not be there. There is one other place I think he would go. Watch and see if we are being followed." I looked behind us as Yin gave the taxi driver more instructions. Several cars came up behind us, but then turned off. There was no sign of the brown sedan.
Do you see anyone back there? Yin asked, turning to look for himself.
I don't think so, I replied.
I was about to question Yin again about what was happening when I noticed that his hands were shaking. I took a good look at his face. It was pale and covered with sweat. I realized that he was terrified. The sight sent a chill of fear through my own body. Before I could speak, Yin pointed out a parking place for the taxi driver and pushed me out of the car with my satchel, leading me down a side street and then into a narrow alley. After walking 100 feet or so, we leaned against the wall of a building and waited for several minutes, our eyes glued to the entrance of the street we had just left. Neither of us spoke a word. When it appeared as though we were not being followed, Yin proceeded down the alley to the next building and knocked several times. There was no answer, but the lock on the door mysteriously opened from the inside. Wait here, Yin said, opening the door. I'll be back. He moved silently into the building and shut the door. When I heard it lock, a wave of panic filled me. Now what? I thought. Yin was scared. Was he abandoning me out here? I looked back down the alley toward the crowded street. This was exactly what I had feared most. Someone seemed to be looking for Yin, and maybe Will too. I had no idea what I might be getting involved in. Perhaps it would be best if Yin did vanish, I thought. That way I could run back to the street and hide among the crowds until I found my way back to the airport. What else could I do then but go back home? I would be absolved of all responsibility to look for Will or do anything else on this misadventure. The door suddenly opened. Yin slid out, and the door was quickly locked. Will left a message, Yin said. Come on. We walked a bit farther down the alley and hid between two large trash bins as Yin opened an envelope and pulled out a note. I watched him as he read. His face seemed to grow even whiter. When he finished, he held the note out toward me. What does it say? I asserted, grabbing the paper. I recognized Will's handwriting as I read. Yin, I'm convinced we are being allowed into Shambhala, but I must go on ahead. It is of utmost importance that you bring our American friend as far as you can. You know that Dakini will guide you. Will. I looked at Yin, who glanced at me for a moment and then looked away. What does he mean, allowed into Shambhala? He means that figuratively, right? He doesn't think it's a real place, does he? Yin was staring at the ground. Of course Will thinks it is a real place, he whispered. Do you? I asked. He looked away, appearing as though the weight of the world had been placed on his shoulders. Yes, yes, he said, only it has been impossible for most people to ever conceive of this place, much less get there. Certainly you and I cannot. His voice trailed off into silence. Yin, I said, you have to tell me what's going on. What is Will doing? Who are these men we saw at the hotel? Yin stared at me for a moment and then said, I think they are Chinese intelligence officers. What? I don't know what they are doing here. Apparently, they have been alerted by all the activity and talk about Shambhala. Many of the lamas here realize that something is changing with this holy place. There has been much discussion. Changing? How? Tell me. Yin took a deep breath. I wanted to let Will explain this, but I guess now I must try. You must understand what Shambhala is. The people there are live human beings, born into this holy place, but they are of a higher evolutionary state. They help hold energy and vision for the whole world. I looked away, thinking about the tenth insight. They're spiritual guides of some kind? Not like you think, Yin replied. They aren't like family members or other souls in the afterlife that might be helping us from that dimension. They are human beings who live right here on this earth. Those in Shambhala have an extraordinary community and live at a higher level of development. They model what the rest of the world will ultimately achieve. Where is this place?
I don't know.
Do you know anyone who has seen it?
No.
As a boy, I studied with a great lama who declared one day that he was going to Shambhala, and after days of celebration, he left.
Did he get there?
No one knows. He disappeared and was never seen again anywhere in Tibet.
Then no one really knows whether it exists or not.
Yin was silent for a moment, then said,
"We have the legends.
Who's we?" He stared at me. I could tell that he was restricted by some kind of code of silence.
"I cannot tell you that. Only the head of our sect, Lama Rigden, could choose to talk with you."
"What are the legends?"
"I can only tell you this. The legends are the sayings left by those who have attempted to reach Shambhala in the past. They are centuries old."
Yin was about to say something else when a sound toward the street drew our attention. We watched closely, but saw no one.
"Wait here," Yin said.
Again, Yin knocked on the door and disappeared inside. Just as quickly, he emerged and walked over to an old rusty jeep with a ragged canvas top. He opened the door and waved for me to get in.
"Come on," he said. "We must hurry."
2. The Call of Shambhala.
As Yin began to drive out of Lhasa, I was silent, looking out at the mountains and wondering what Will had meant by his note. Why had he decided to go on alone? And who were the Dakini? I was about to ask Yin when a Chinese military truck crossed at the intersection in front of us. The sight gave me a jolt, and I felt a wave of nervousness begin to fill my body. What was I doing? We had just seen intelligence officers staking out the hotel where we were supposed to meet Will. They might be looking for us.
"Wait a minute, Yin," I said. "I want to go to an airport. All this seems too dangerous for me."
Yin looked at me with alarm.
"What about Will?" he said. "You read the note. He needs you."
"Yeah, well, he's used to this kind of stuff. I'm not sure he would expect me to put myself in danger like this."
"You are already in danger. We must get out of Lhasa."
"Where are you going?" I asked.
"To Lama Rigden's monastery near Shigatse. It will be late when we get there."
"Is there a phone there?" I asked.
"Yes," Yin replied. "I believe so, if it is working."
I nodded, and Yin turned back to concentrate on the road. That's fine, I thought. It wouldn't hurt to get far away from here before making arrangements to get home. For hours we bounced along on the badly paved highway, passing trucks and old cars along the way. The scenery was a mix of ugly industrial developments and beautiful vistas. Well after dark, Yin pulled up into the yard of a small concrete block house. A big, woolly dog was tied to the side of a mechanic's garage to the right, barking at us furiously.
"Is this Lama Rigden's house?" I asked.
"No, of course not," Yin said. "But I know the people here. We can pick up some food and gasoline that we might need later. I'll be right back."
I watched as Yin walked up the board steps and knocked on the door. An older Tibetan woman came out and immediately pulled Yin into a full embrace. Yin pointed at me, smiled, and said something I couldn't understand. He waved for me, and I got out and walked into the house. A moment later, we heard the faint squeaks of brakes outside. Yin darted across the room and pulled back the curtains to look. I stood right behind him. In the darkness, I could see a black, unmarked car sitting on the side of the road across from the rutted driveway, 100 feet away.
"Who is that?" I asked.
"I don't know," Yin replied.
"Go out and get our packs, quickly." I looked at him questioningly.
"It's okay," he said. "Go get them, but hurry."
I walked out the door and over to the jeep, trying not to look toward the car in the distance. I reached through the open window and grabbed my satchel and Yin's pack and then briskly walked back inside. Yin was still watching out the window.
"Oh my," he said suddenly. "They are coming."
A blast of car lights lit the window as the car raced toward the house. Grabbing his pack from me with one hand, Yin led the way out the back door and into the darkness.
"We must go this way."
Yin yelled back at me as he led me up a path into a group of rocky foothills. I glanced back down at the house and, to my horror, saw plainclothes agents piling out of the car and encircling the residence. Another car we hadn't even seen sped around the side of the house, and several more men jumped out and began to run up the slope to our right. I knew if we kept going in the direction we were going, they would cut us off in minutes.
"Yin, wait a minute," I said in a loud whisper. "They're heading us off."
He stopped and put his face very close to mine in the darkness.
"To the left," he said. "We'll go around them."
As he said that, I caught sight of the other agents running in that direction. If we followed Yen's route, they would see us for sure. I looked straight up the most rugged part of the incline. Something caught my eye. A dim patch of the trail was perceptibly lighter.
"No, we have to go straight up," I said instinctively, and headed in that direction.
Yin lagged behind me for an instant and then hurriedly followed. We made our way up the rocks, with the agents closing in from the right. At the top of a rise, an agent seemed to be right on top of us, and we ducked between two large boulders. The area around us was still perceptibly lighter. The man was no more than 30 feet away, moving around to where he would soon see us clearly. Then, as he approached the edges of the slight glow, seconds from seeing us, he abruptly stopped, started to walk forward again, then stopped again, as if suddenly having other ideas. Without taking another step, he turned and ran back down the hill. After a few moments, I asked Yin in a whisper if he thought the agent had seen us.
"No," Yin replied, "I do not think so. Come on."
We climbed the hill for another 10 minutes before stopping on a stony precipice to look back down at the house. We could see more official-looking cars driving up. One was an older police car with a blinking red light. The scene filled me with terror. No doubt about it now, these people were after us. Yin was also looking anxiously toward the house, his hands again shaking.
"What are they going to do to your friend?" I asked, horrified at what he might say.
Yin looked at me with tears and fury in his eyes, then led the way farther up the hill. We walked for several more hours, making our way by the light of a quarter moon that was periodically obscured by clouds. I wanted to ask about the legends Yin had mentioned, but he remained angry and sullen. At the top of the hill, Yin stopped and announced that we must rest. As I sat down on a nearby rock, he walked off into the darkness a dozen feet or so and stood with his back toward me.
"Why were you so sure," he asked without turning around, "that we should climb straight up the hill back there?"
I took a breath.
"I saw something," I stammered. "The area was lighter somehow. It seemed the way to go."
He turned and walked over and sat down on the ground across from me.
"Have you seen such a thing before?"
I tried to shake away my anxiety. My heart was pounding and I could barely talk.
"Yeah, I have," I said, "several times recently."
He looked away and was silent.
"Yin, do you know what is happening?"
"The legends would say we are being helped."
"Helped? By whom?"
Again, he just looked away.
"Yin, tell me what you know about this."
He did not respond.
"Is it the bikini that Will mentioned in his note?"
Still no response.
I felt a rush of anger. "Yin, tell me what you know."
He stood up quickly and glared at me.
"Some things we are forbidden to speak of, don't you understand? Just mentioning the names of these beings frivolously can leave a man mute for years, or blind. They are the guardians of Shambhala."
He stormed over to a flat rock, spread his jacket, and lay down. I felt exhausted too, unable to think.
"We must sleep," Yin said. "Please, you will know more tomorrow."
I looked at him for a moment longer, then lay down on the rock where I was sitting and fell into a deep sleep.